hour 30. I should apologize because my English is not so good like this. So. For beginning, let me just show you the outline. In the first introductory part, I will try more or less to motivate what the Goofy theory is in the main lines and why the introduction of colors in short field. The second and third part would be main curse, and there I will try to show you how can we study scaling behavior
of the Feynman amplitude in those graphs, in both theories, starting by dimension 4, which is just the Auguri model, and trying to extend those scaling behavior in any dimension. Then after, in the fourth part, I will try to show you a new representation of this model by integrating out two colors, two fields. And this leads to interesting properties also, which can be useful in constitutive analysis. The last part will be, I just will give a summary of our results and the perspective of this work. Let me start by some generality in group field theories and mention that group field theories are, loosely speaking, quantum field theories of a group manifolds. They were introduced in the beginning of the 90s after the work by Bulatov and Auguri. And it is widely believed today that they will provide one of the most fundamental frameworks for addressing the background field theory of quantum gravity. By background free theory, we understand just the fact that we have to resum over topologies and geometries of a kind of a space. I will try to show you how can you understand this sum. You have to sum over topologies. You have, at least, I will try to show you how can such a sum can be defined in the next slide, but not now. For the moment, let me come back onto the most basic properties of those group field theories. They are gauge invariant, and by gauge invariant here we understand just the fact that you have to, when you multiply the field arguments by a fixed group element on the left or on the right or by the adjoint action, you will have the same answer. And secondly, you have also the non-locality. These theories are non-local, and by non-locality here we understand just the fact that the field arguments are paired in a specific way. And that's actually, this particular pairing has to see with gluing of simplices in simplicial geometry. Let me be a little bit more illustrative and discuss the well-known models, which are just the three-dimensional situation, which is just the Bulatov model, and here the four-dimensional group field theory, namely the Auguri model for just trivial, that's the most simplest situation. Here fields, are, first of all, I introduce a group. The group is just SU2, and you consider only this R measure. This is it. Fields here can be represented by half line. Don't forget about this thing. It's just that three strands. We used to call this thread strands. And fields can be represented by three strands. Each of these strands can be associated with a particular group element. Here is the covariance. The covariance is the product of three delta functions, each identifying field's argument 2 by 2 like this, but with a gauge invariant constraint, which is nothing but the mean value over the group here in that situation. Here is the vertex of your vertex. The vertex is simply a product of 6 delta functions in this case. And for instance, here, this field argument is paired with this one, and here you just have your delta function, and so on. In this picture, you can consider only Feynman graphs as a collection of vertices glued by the covariance rule. Let me now introduce you a new way that you can understand the same theory, is just by saying the following. If you look at each field and as a triangle, making each strand like this as an edge, you will see that a collection of 4 triangles, which is this vertex, can be viewed as a triangle. Now, a Feynman graph would be only in that picture, that dual picture, can be viewed just as a simplicial complex. Now, when you try to resum over all the Feynman graphs, now you try to sum over the topologies of your manifolds. This is the main idea in the grid lines. Should agree with that. Now, let me just continue quickly and show you how what's happened in the four-dimensional situation. You have here four fields, which are complex or real-valued functions of four copies of the group. Four refers to the dimension. Here is the covariance, is a product of four delta function in this situation, by together with that gauge invariant condition that you have to take onto the fields. Here is a vertex of your theory, is just a product now of 10 delta function, which just identify 2 by 2 the field of your interaction. Here is now the dual picture. Fields can be viewed as tetrahedron. Each strand can be viewed as a triangle. And a collection of 4 or 5 tetrahedron can be seen as a 4-semplex. And we used to call this 4-semplex a pentachord. Now, the question is, since I have introduced that group field theories as the usual quantum field theories with Feynman graphs and amplitude and things like this, it should be natural to ask the question of normalizability. So let me quickly remind, according to the ideas of our group, how do we define a renormalization group analysis? There is 3 main ingredients that you can code. The first is a scale analysis. The scale analysis just governs, tell you what is the energy scale or something. Let me just say that it's just governed. It gives a sense to the renormalization group. It tells you what is high and what is low, what is small and what is long. Roughly speaking, you can just say what is on the left and what is on the right. Why do we introduce such idea of left and right and not small and long? This has to see actually with the fact that with some non-local theories, such as in non-commutative geometries, we face some varied properties like the UV-IR mixing. And in that situation, you are not able to know exactly what are the scales a priori. So it is only through a kind of new duality that can be called the Langmann-Szabo duality, which is a kind of symmetry, that you can disentangle that properties, and you can understand that small distances remain small distances, but long distances should not be considered as long distances in the usual way, but just center of mass long distances. So this is not obvious a priori, so the scales should be defined before telling anything. Now, the second point is a power counting theorem. A power counting theorem tells you, according to the topology of your graph, which graph are the most divergent ones and require so your attention. Should be actually treated, should be renormalized. The last point is a generalized locality principle, which is a subtle principle which involves actually the first 2 points, first 2 ingredients, and can be stated in that way. It's a kind of selection principle which tells you, according to the topology of your graphs, so I invoke the second point, according to the scale of your graph, which energy scale do you consider it, how can you recast it in a form of a term already present in the theory? If you want, this can be rephrased in the following way. If when you want to probe an object of a given scale with an object, different object with a lower scale, you are not able to see anything else than a basic object. Or this sentence, which is actually the sentence of Vincent Rivasso, he say that when you look at an object very far from you, it looks like a point. Okay, this is actually the main property to make. This is why we call it locality. But actually, we should be careful because it can be anything. It can be a generalized locality principle, not in the sense of something which happens locally, like interactions which are local, but sometimes you can have in non-commutative space such interaction which can be non-local in the form of a tetrahedron or a parallel of that vertices. So the principle may change according to your theory. Okay.
why that's called localic, generalized localic. Can you just talk a little bit more about that?
Mm-hmm. So actually, when you have the usual 5-4 theory, let me just say in 5-4 theory, like this, and now you have
your 4-point function, like that, you would have the same thing plus some correction. You would like that actually you can send this object onto a local object, which is empty. Now, in more complicated theory, you can have, you don't have this kind of interaction, basic interaction, but more complicated one. You want to retest them in that form. What about now normalization and group free theories? It's something which is new, at least, and let me focus on that two contributions. The first one is a work by Fredel, Gouraud, and Umeti, which is published this year in PRD. And in this paper, they perform a systematic analysis of the Bulatov model, so three-dimensional situation, in theory for three dimensions. And in this paper, they were able to identify what they call types on graphs, and for which they were able to formulate an exact power count interval. And also, they conjecture the following: type 1 graph will dominate at the large spin regime. Let me just come back to those type 1 graph power counting. It's okay, it's like this. Given a cutoff lambda in the theory, which is just a cutoff in the spin, so implicitly they think that, this author thinks that the spins, the high spin and low spins, are the scales of your theory. So this is implicitly what they mean here. So let's follow them. And here you've got capital lambda to the power, the number of bubbles minus one. Bubbles here means a bubble is just a graph which can be dually associated with a semplicial complex of which the boundary is a two sphere, if you want. Now tau.
Sorry?
You can shrink your diagram to a point and you just have external legs.
Yes,
that's
yeah.
What you mean by type 1.
Yes, actually, if you have, it's a kind of, let me just show you, you can have many external legs, but most it's the kind of things like this, okay? It's a tree of things like that. Okay, this is a type 1 graph. And you can contract it, as you say, if this is what you need, you can contract it to a certain types of graphs. And what they achieve here is the following, according to my first three main principle. It's a partial power counting theorem because they only
do it for types on graph. But what they want, actually, this author, what they conjecture is the following. They want that types on graph will be the dominant one, that is to say, will govern your locality principle, your generalized locality principle. This is what they want. Okay, so it's actually the most advanced paper, if you want, in the market. Now let's have a look onto the second one. It's a paper by Magnon, Nui, Rivasso, and Smerlac, published also this year. I will call this paper MNRS, and this one FBO. Okay? So in this paper, MNRS actually studied the scaling behavior of still the Bulatov model for three-dimensional, and also they studied also the scaling behavior of the Fredel and Luab constructive regularization. The Fredel and Luab constructive regularization, if you want, is just an additive vertex that Fredel and Luab put in the theory in order to make the whole vertex be positive. This is what they want. And this is useful when you have to tackle the problem of constructive analysis, when you need stabilities and resummation series. You need the intersection statements. Now, in that paper, so there is that bound. They found the following bound for only Feynman amplitude for graphs without generalized at all. This is a way that those graphs behave. You've got capital lambda to the power 3/2. Still here, they consider that the energies, the scales, are given in terms of spins. Okay, the same idea. Now you've got capital lambda to the power 3/2, which is that the natural bound for vertex operator inside of the graph times the number of vertices inside of your graph. This is, in general, the way that behaves the Feynman amplitudes for the Bulatov model, but without generalized that. Yes?
Question. So lambda is something like an infrared cutoff?
No, you cannot say, this is the way that you can see. When you have a cutoff in the spin, you have to sum when you expand. I will come back to that And you cut off with us. You don't have, you have to sum over all spins, but now you stop to a certain spin.
Right. So, so to
it's actually, if you want, it's a kind of UV cutoff in the spin. Yes, I agree with you.
Yeah, but if the spins were areas in the loop quantum gravity treatment, this would be a cutoff at large areas, so it's a kind of infrared cutoff.
Yes, yes, I agree. It could be understood in that way.
Okay, just so I understand.
Actually, there is that nice word introduced by HTK. He said that we shouldn't say UV, but ultra spin cutoff. So maybe.
So, okay, there was also more properties about constructive analysis that they have derived in that paper.
Of connected function?
Connected function. Okay. Actually, if you don't mind, in your paper, you study the summability of the partial function. It should not be good enough. Okay, you should write the constructive analysis of the connected function, which is easiest to do.
It's more complicated to do. It's easier?
It's easier.
Oh, okay. Good.
Sometimes life is interesting.
Okay. It's more,
if you want, okay. Now, if I say easiest, it may be more fundamental. Because at least not that you have the good tools. Okay, so this, okay, I have here mentioned that they were able to identify that bound for Feynman amplitudes for graph without generalized at all. But what about graph with generalized at all? It actually, there was that idea that they think that generalized at all will be not so important, and this bound will remain the same. It turns out to be not true, to be wrong. And the quick way to recognize this fact is the following. If you have such insertion of non-planar tadpoles, and let me just show you, if I'm still in three dimensions, so this is my vertex, if you want, and I take another non-planar tadpole here, like this, if I shift it here, I will have for this vertex operators one loop outside, one loop inside, and one loop in that point. So for this vertex operator, the previous bound of capital lambda to the power 3/2 is not good, is not true. For this vertex operator, you've got a contribution of a capital lambda to the power 3. So the previous bound turns out to be wrong. And this may affect two things in your theory. First of all, it can affect your normalization process. Because what they actually want is to remove all singularities such that you can obtain. So you just have a capital lambda to the power of the number of vertices. This is what they want. Actually, they find 3/2. So that may affect the renormalization process because you want to be the lowest possible before starting your renormalization process. And now, actually, with those generalized at all, you've got 3. So that becomes worse. And more than that, when you try to obtain the radius of convergence of your connected function, of the part of the perturbation series of your connected function, it depends inversely on to that bound. So it becomes smaller and smaller if you insert those graphs inside of your field. Moreover, such kind of graphs like this, where you've got a strands leaving one leg, going into a complicated graph and coming back with the same legs here, turns out to be associated with singular manifolds in the sense of the Pietri and Petronio in the paper of 2000. But don't ask me more, I cannot say more, but it turns out to be associated with a very bad behavior for the manifold that can be triangulated by those graphs. So such kind of bad behavior is something which is very not good. What can we do? You've got two possibilities. you can come back to the paper of De Pietri and Petronio, look at carefully what are the conditions that they implement on their model in order to remove those singularities. It may be difficult. If you don't have those ideas, you can do the following. And let me just introduce you something before. It's a fermionic color group field theory in any dimension introduced by Guro this year. And let me quickly, by color here, we understand just an extra index in the fields. You've got just a field like this, which is indexed now by an extra index like this, and it runs from to the dimension plus one. And for this theory, it's fermionic because it just is associated with Grassmann variables, Grassmann Hort variables at the start in your Lagrange formulation. Now, this index here, it just gives you a SUD plus one symmetry in the fields. It's just a global symmetry on the fields that you have. But also, for those color graphs, you've got a computable homology, which is quite good, but it can also pseudo-manifold. But if you want a nice time, you only have kind of conical singularities. So it's an improvement, if you want. And more than that, the bubbles, which are those divergent objects that you can obtain, can be easily seen directly, readily, when you look at the graphs. It can be easiest. It's just a game of color, okay, a game of index, and you are able to identify properly your bubbles inside of this graph. And moreover, what interests us, there is no tadpole. I will give a rigorous proof of these statements inside of my talk, and in Greek dimension. Yes.
So in these models, there's no embedding. These are not. These graphs do not have to be duals of triangulations.
They do not appear. They do not appear at all.
Right. Mm-hmm. If you require that they be duals of triangulations of say S3 or T3, mm-hmm. would you eliminate these tadpoles?
I'm sorry.
If you require that the graphs be duals. Of a triangulation of a manifold, so that mm-hmm. the local manifold conditions were always satisfied.
Yeah.
Would you eliminate the tadpoles, or would you weaken the tadpoles?
Actually, those kinds of that I will eliminate them. Okay, this is the way that you should do if you don't want to have more complicated situation. I mean, when you have cut in your manifolds, those graph appears. Okay, those triangulation, typical triangulation occur. This is to say, if you don't want to have cuts in your manifold like this, okay, it's not just point-like singularities, but actually good cuts or I don't know, some, you have to remove them. And the nicest ways, and we should be honest at that level, the nicest ways to do that without introducing color and everything is to look at carefully the paper of the Pietri and Petronio. But it's a rather involved paper. And maybe we have to come back to that feature in the future. Why? Yeah. But for the moment, this introduction of colors has to see with the fact that we just want to go quickly behind the first difficulties that we face. Okay, we just want to know exactly what is the deeper structure by just jumping around the things. Okay.
So I'm jumping ahead in front. You're going to do that. But even so, is there a relation between having color graphs and having a manifold?
Yes, there is. Yes, there is. And so it's not actually, if you have a manifold, manifold can be triangulated by color graph, but color graph can triangulate more than manifold. It can triangulate also pseudo manifolds, but of a nice kind with only point like singularities.
I see. So using colors or restricting to certain types of manifolds is equivalent in some way. That you're going to explain.
Yes, I should be careful what we understand quickly, but maybe, roughly speaking, yes. Okay, this is actually linked. And it turns out that only colored graphs like this are able to have a computable homology. Okay, the way that you can quickly see that there is a common way to define homology when you have faces, you have lines and vertex, you should obtain just an empty dense matrix between face and lines, by that code FL, and an empty dense matrix between lines and vertices. But now, if you want more than faces, actually this just can be given by orientation. If you want here, the color is just an orientation of your faces and things like this. But if you want more, if you want bubbles, okay, you should improve your labels and put some colors onto the bubbles. And this gives you a new matrix, and you can define recursively like this the manifold, the kind of types of manifold.
Mm-hmm. If you're saying, let's say, if I understand the Petronio classification, the Petronio, mm-hmm. So like three types of, let's say, triangulation. One which is manifold-like,
yeah.
The one which has only kind of pond-like similarities, where the bubbles are genus G.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this extra which have topology of being a knot or a line.
I said that I'm not aware about all okay. That they are talking. Okay,
but it's a different type of
thing. Yes, they are identified nice features of what kind of triangulation may lead you to a good manifold. This is the main idea of the paper.
It's just that the singularity now is one dimensional.
Yes, I think so.
Okay.
Okay. May I? So,
my goal today is to introduce you a bosonic version of that model, to restate in a more rigorous way the previous bound obtained by MNRF, okay, that paper, and trying to make it in any dimension, starting by dimension 4, and also to show you that by using an explicit integration of two colors of the model, you can reach the hidden positivity, so you don't need actually the Feder and Loire constructive analysis term that you have to keep up. So the model is really positive. This is just the archive of the last number of this word. Okay. M is Magnin. Magnin Rivasso. Benjelloun Magnin. Okay, so let me start by the Ogury model. For the four-dimensional situation, here fields are just complex-valued fields. Let me just take complex-valued fields of a four-copy of the group SU2. L here is just the color index, as I mentioned. We are in four dimensions, so here L runs from 1 to 5. Here is the two gauge invariant condition that I have mentioned. You have, when you multiply by the left a fixed with a group, fixed group element, you will remain with the same answer. And here is also the same condition for the phi bar. You have your station. Like now, let me explain you quickly the action. The action for only gauge invariant fields can be written like this. You've got a sum of mass terms, okay? And it is just simple things. And two interactions with two coupling constants, lambda 1 and lambda 2. You've got phi 1, phi 2, phi 3, phi 4, and phi 5, which is the whole set of colors which is inside. Theory. The particular pattern followed by the sub-indices is actually the pattern followed by the previous interaction linking 2 by 2 the field arguments. Same thing for the phi bar. Now let me show you the partition function for this model. In the two coupling constant lambda 1 and lambda 2 is a usual exponentiation of the interaction part of n that you have to integrate over the measure. This measure should include the usual Lebesgue measure for the fields, the gauge invariant condition, and the sum of mass terms. How do you do that? It's just by defining properly your covariance. So the covariance is the following. You have a covariance in the two index color index with 8 field arguments because you've got four group arguments. It is defined in the following way. And you say that only phi bar should be able to contract with phi, and only two colors of the same color could be contractible. Like this. You have this mean value over the group and a product of delta function identifying 2 by 2 the field arguments. Now let me just show you how this, the vertex and the covariance appear in general. These are there. The covariance here is you've got you contract phi bar here with a phi there. So the covariance is oriented. You want because the model is complex, you have to identify each field arguments 2 by 2 like this. The color should be the same, And also you have that case invariant pointing to the mean value of it. This is a covariance, it's a complicated object. Let's have a look now onto the vertex operator, which is much simpler. You call this vertex a pentacore, as I said. You've got two vertices, one for the 5 and one for the 5R. Let me show you how can you label this vertex. The second, you obtain the second one, you just have to take the reverse order of everything. Now you take a preferred orientation like this, and you start by labeling the legs, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Now, if you take, for instance, 1, you have to label the substrand, the strands of each legs. For instance, this one is 1, 2, because it's the strands leading 1 going to 2. Here is, so 2, 1, natural. And here you see a delta function. So you've got here delta of 1, 2, 2, 1. Mm-hmm. So you do the same. Now you have to take the reverse order of your previous orientation. 1, 2, 1, 3, 1, 4, and 1, 5. As you see, let's go around. Let me show you how do you do for 5. 5, 1, 5, 2, 5, 3, 5, 4. So nothing. There is nothing special here. But let's have a look now on 4. You've got 4, 5, which goes from 4 to 5. But after 4, 5, you don't have anything. So you come back to 1. 4, 1, 4, 2, 4. Like this. And this is a unique way that you can label your, this is the way that you can label uniquely your strands in order to have a well-defined theory. Now let me list you quickly and try to prove the main Feynman, the properties of the Feynman graphs in general in this theory. First of all, for an n-point graph with n internal vertices, if one color is missing on the external length, then the number of internal vertex should be even. The number of external legs should be even, and the external legs have color appearing in pair, 2 by 2. Let me quickly show you why. It's not a complicated statement. If you have a Feynman graph with n external legs, if one color is missing outside, this is to say that it should be fully contracted inside. This is to say the n half line associated with that color should be fully contracted. That makes the number of internal vertex to be even. If you have, this is just for the little a, for the little b, you can understand it in that way. If you have a number of external legs, hard number of external legs, this is to say, and you still have one color missing outside. Hmm? This is the hypothesis. Now, this tells you that for this color, it should appear a hard number of a particular color. I don't know. Okay, I have external legs like this. Okay, I have n internal vertices. If one color appears a hard number of times, but I know that my number of internal vertices is even, this is impossible to fully contract them. So there's a problem there. So this is actually the first constraint that we see on the particular configuration of your Feynman graph. Yeah, it's actually that imposed constraint on your Feynman graph. Well, so this makes actually that the number of external legs should be even, and color must appear by pair, 2 by 2 like this. Second statement, there is no hard point function with a number of external legs less than 5 in the colored Ogre model. This is actually a corollary of the first statement. If you have a number of external legs with a number of external legs less than 5, this is to say that you've got one missing color. And from the previous statement, you see that n should be given, so a number of all external legs cannot be. This is impossible to obtain. Now, a phase, which is a closed cycle, follow if you have a strand, a collection of strands like this, up to a point that it will close. For this phase, you've got only 2 colors. So there is each phase possesses only 2 colors possible, like this. And a chain, which is an open cycle of length bigger than 1, is also has 2 colors. Let me come back and show you. Oops. Let me show you why. For instance, let me follow these strands, 1, 2. If it comes into the strands 1, 2 here, because only color 1 should contact with color 1, you have 1, 2, going to 1, 2, you will leave with a color 2 and come back up to that point, which with the color 2. So I had 1, and after 2, coming back to two, leaving with one again. So you are only possible, when you start with strands 1, 2, you will only have 1 and 2 for color for those circuits. Quickly, this actually is the same for open chain. There is not generalized at all in the color group field model. Let me just show you why. It's because of the previous statements. Let me have a look onto that thing. It's a hard point function with a number of external legs less than 5, so this configuration cannot happen. This one, when you don't have any obliges, it's a one-point function, cannot happen also. So only this guy and this guy are able to happen because you've got a given number of external legs. But from the first statements here, the color should, the external legs should have color appear 2 by 2. This makes that 2 legs obligatory to, with the same color. So these 2 legs share the same color. But this excludes this vertex in your theory because the usual vertex possesses 5 different colors. So this vertex is not a vertex of your theory. This configuration cannot happen. The same idea can be reproduced here in order to say that this configuration cannot happen because if you have 2 legs with the same color, this vertex is obligatory outside of your theory. Now, the most important thing that we have in for Feynman graph is the following. For a color connected 2-point graph, there exists an exhaustive sequence of cuts for the graph. An exhaustive sequence of cuts is the total ordering of the vertices of your theory in a such way that you can pull from one part, subpart of your vertices, you can pull one by one the vertices from a part A to a part B in a way that both of the 2 parts remain connected. This is what we call an exhaustive sequence of cuts, and you can label by a total ordering each vertex of your theory. So it's a perfect labeling, a good ordered labeling. How can you see that? Actually, that comes from the fact that you don't have any generalized tadpole. The absence of generalized tadpole make possible the exhaustive sequence of cuts. Let me quickly show you what's going on here. A generalized tadpole is something which is like this with like that. Okay. And it hooks to a more complicated graphs. Okay. Imagine that I pull one by one, okay, the vertices from a part A to a part B. I pull one by one the vertices up to the point that I come to that vertex. If I cut here, this part becomes disconnected of the remaining part. This shows you that it cannot fully connect it. So you are violating the inequalities. This is not good. And the presence or the absence of generalized tadpole, if you want, the rigorous proof is rather tricky. Okay, you have to be careful and it's a lengthy proof, but this is the main idea that I just want to show you is the flavor of the proof. And this is why, if you don't have generalized tadpole, you are able to label uniquely each vertex of your complicated graph. And this is actually very useful. Now, let's go into deep water and now try to understand how can you bound each graph of this theorem. Now, I introduce a cutoff, which is just a sum. Up to, I use a Peter Weyl field expansion for group, for the group, and I expand each field in the following way. I sum over each representation, the spin representation, up to a certain order, capital lambda, which is my cutoff. I here have the following trace, which is the usual product of representation of these, rather by G1, G2, G3, and G4. At that level, you can see immediately that this element, this number, is a tensor. And this is why also people used to claim that group field theory has higher rank field theories. Okay, they generalize scalar field theories, they generalize automatic field theories around fields. So this is the way that you can see. Now, here is your delta function, and it diverges in the following way, capital lambda to the power 3. Theorem. There exists a constant K such that for any connected colored vacuum graph G of the Auguri model with n internal vertices, you have the Feynman amplitude for this graph is bounded by an inessential constant K, capital lambda to the power 9.5 times the number of vertices plus the final trace, which is useless. And this bound is optimal in the sense that you have, you can You can obtain, you can have graphs which behave exactly like this at the large spin region. Now a proof of this thing can be done in the following way. I need now to understand the structure of any kind of graphs. Doing so, I need an exhaustive second of that. This is my unique tool that I can use here. Now, how do you do that? You just say that I have that very complicated graphs, and I have to understand the structures of each vertex inside of my graph. I have to understand that, and how can they appear? How are the configurations of both vertex operators? When you pull a vertex, how can it appear to you? It can be like this, 1 gives 4. It can be like this, 2 gives 3. Or 3 gives 2, which is the adjoint of this operator, and 4 gives 1, which is the adjoint of this one. So only those two operators are the generic ones with their adjoint are generic of your graph from the exhaustive seconds. Now, let me show you how can you bound this operator. You can do the same thing for the same ID. Now, 014 is the operator sending one field onto 4 fields. This space is a subspace of the L2 function over 3 copies of G. Here you have to truncate them. This is why I put here capital lambda, but also you only consider gate invariant fields. A norm onto that operator is just the following, is a limit of a trace composition of the operators to the power on 1/2 n. Now, let me just show you what is that object trace of 014, which is the adjoint of 014 times n. When you take 014, yes, and 041, you'd have this one and the other its adjoint, and you glue them, you will only have one element here of this chain. When you compose an n times, you have an object like this, and you finally try take a trace like that, and you obtain that object. So that trace is the amplitude of this graph. How do you define this now, the amplitude of this graph? Actually, you have to understand the following things. When you introduce that covariance in the form of the mean integral value over the group, the product of delta function, actually there is something which is underlined in this theory is the following. And to measure the amplitude of this graph, you have to take an integral product of many copies of the groups. And also, for each line, you have to take a group element labeling the line, the variables, and a product of delta functions along all faces of your graphs. This is actually a more, if you want, is a result of the first integration over the group elements, which makes this thing happen, and it's associated usually to the fact that you just have to take the holonomies. These are the holonomies of the group collection, of the SU2 group connection along faces of your graph. This is the main idea of Boulatov when he introduces this model. Now you have to perform, it's just integration of a delta function, you integrate. It is just one up to the point that you obtain a redundant delta function. So it counts, you count lambda to the power 3. So you do it carefully and count the number of redundant delta function that you can obtain in this graph. And you obtain, actually, this is a bound. So capital lambda to the power 3, 3n plus 3, which is the number of redundant delta function, as I said. And now you divide everybody by 2 and send n to infinity. This is a bound of 014. Do the same thing for 023, then you obtain this bound, this one dominates this one, so this one is the greatest bound for your any graph of any types of graphs. Well, so this was the main idea for the proof for the previous theorem. Now let's have a look how can the dimension act on that bound. If you increase the dimension, what happened then? And I pass now into the third point, the third section, and I introduce you now the color group field theory in any dimension. This is it. So you take diameter variables with color index L running from 1 to d plus 1. You've got these are complex valued functions over d copies of the group. This is the action for gauge invariant field. Sum of mass terms, two interactions looking like that. okay, you have just the same thing, phi 1, phi 2, phi 3, up to phi d plus 1. Same thing for the phi bar. Now, let me just rephrase this thing up to some diagrammatics. You have this, this is a covariance, it's just a product of delta, of now d delta function, and oriented like this, with a gauge invariant constraint on the mean value of it. This is the vertex operator, I just draw it for phi. Same thing, if you're in order to obtain for the phi bar, you know what to do, you just take the reverse order, and you, for the phi, simple, take a preferred orientation, sublabel everybody on the other way around, as you have to do it in the previous, as I said, previous. Now, let me show you how what happened for this theorem. This is a theorem for the dimension, but this is a theorem stating the dimension, the bounds for the Feynman amplitude for any colored graph in any dimension, a vacuum graph. So this is a bound for the Feynman amplitude, k to the n, capital lambda to the power 3, d minus 1, d minus 2, the number of vertices divided by 4, plus a final trace. This bound is optimal in the sense that there is this diagram which saturates this bound and allows to break. How do you do that? Actually, you need an exhaustive sequence of cuts, as I previously said, and it turns out to be also, you can obtain such a things because here also, in any dimension, you don't have generalized at all. The same idea, this is the same idea actually. And because this feature does not depend on the dimension. If you have a complicated generalized at all like this with a number of external, if you have two color appearing on the external legs, this excludes this vector from your theory. If you now, how do you bound these graphs? Any kind of graph. You've got your exhaustive sequence of that. You have to identify the configurations. And here is the most general vertex operator that you can have. You can have your P legs and D plus 1 minus P legs on the other side. And you do the same thing that I have previously mentioned. Now you find the maximal bound is for the graph with OB1. Which is reminiscent of long 1-4. So if you have the same thing, this is why here you don't have any appearance of the P. But something also which is striking is the following. When D equals 1 and D equals 2, you don't, the Feynman amplitude does not depend on your internal vertices. So I mean for lower dimensional groups. For the moment, I don't understand why, but actually it does only depend on this final trace, which is actually useless. So this can be important. I don't know. Yes, I know that. But what does that mean for the graphs? Does it say that
it's trivial that you've got a normalization there? It's trivial that because that does not depend on the number
that we have inside. So, and even here, that does not for d equals 1. You don't have any contribution. So actually, something is totally convergent. I don't know. Okay, so this was my three main parts in the for the scaling properties. Let me quickly pass without transition now onto the integration of two colors and show you why this problem is positive. Now, what you have to do is just to have to overlap to collapse these two coupling constants. We just put them to be equals lambda. You rewrite your partition function in the following way by singling out phi 1 and phi 2, phi bar 2 and phi bar 1, because I want to integrate over that two colors. I had everybody inside of this kernel operator, this complicated kernel, that one. I have hidden there the remaining field. Now, if you do that, you can rewrite your previous partition function just as a Gaussian integral, where A is that matrix. I have forgotten to mention that H and H star, the previous two operators, are adjoint. So this can be integrated explicitly if you with that E, which is just the general part and real part of phi 1 and phi 2. You will obtain the following Matthew-Salam determinant, which is called things. And you have just that inverse of the deck of the determinant that you can rewrite in terms of the E trace law. And now we have to show that this loop vertex, this is what we call a loop vertex in constructive analysis, is the, sorry? C is a previous covariance. Is how covariance in the theory, which is actually when you integrate, you should have a appearance of that vertex. Now, this I have to show that this vertex is positive, and I have first of all to introduce that CA, which is just the covariance times this matrix A, is a sum of two matrices, one up, one down, lower and upper triangular matrix. Okay. Now, if I divide that two guys like this, and using the properties that the square of that two guys is zero, and the trace of the hard power is zero, now you can rewrite this loop vertex in the following way, like that, where Q now is that operator, the matrix operator. And it turns out that this matrix is real, which is has a real positive eigenvalue. And if you want this guy to be positive, such that this log will be positive, you have to put that your coupling constant to be purely imaginary. So this was actually the main, and so we don't need any regularity. Now, sorry. Yeah.
If this means this has to something to see with physics, I just don't know. But okay, let me draw quickly the conclusion here. We are have obtained perturbative
bounds for general graphs, vacuum graphs for color group theories in any dimension. This shows you that we can obtain bounds. Okay, there exist bounds. And this is actually a good introduction for normalization. And we are also, this study has allowed us to know that generalized dipole may be very, very not dangerous, but at least we have to be careful with that. Okay, so the model is positive in the coupling constant. If the coupling constant is purely imaginary, we don't need any regularization procedure. And using a loop vertex expansion, you can show that at least for the constant mod fields, that series of connected functions, okay, can be proved to be summable, okay, Borel summable, if you want, for this one. Now, the perspective. These bounds has to be refined in order to obtain a good power counting. Okay, these are just rough bounds. You have to refine them, exclude those previous linear configurations which are not actually very useful. We think that you can refine them, and at least there is another way that you can do group theories, and which can be useful also. It's the following: you can establish actually a power counting theorem for a simplified colored O-group, but in any dimension, you can do it in any dimension with a commutative group. So you consider now a group theory with a commutative group, okay, R or U1, like this. And actually, we prove that this linearized model possesses a power counting, which depends actually on the homology of the theory. This work is in progress. Now, lastly, is the following. We have also to be more or less, have to regard, consider more physically interesting problem, such as the angle of Pereira, Levin, Rovelli, Friedel, Krasnov model, and actually how can we tackle the problem? How can we address the issue of the power counting for those models? The first way that you can think about is just to find actually a linearization and to put colors onto that models. But first of all, you need a grouping formulation of the problems. And actually, after we remove those artifacts and see what happens. So I will thank you again for your
attention. Questions?
So if you look ahead, is there going to be something like a classification of group field theories into renormalizable, non-renormalizable, marginal, the way that it is?
We are very far from this goal. We actually want actually to understand at that moment it would be actually a final goal which would be interesting. But for the moment, it goes beyond our parts because the configuration of those graphs are so numerous. There is many kinds of configuration that not it's quite impossible to say something for the moment about generalizability. For the topological model, even for the topological model like the Bowie model and the Fourier model, the classification of Bowie theory according to the dimension or according to what would be actually a very ambitious goal. But I just don't, maybe I don't understand your question.
No, no, you do.
Okay.
well, what about, to continue this question, what about something intermediary that is, I mean, in the case of matrix model, you know, there's something intermediate, which is this notion of planarity. And you have theory which has no normalizable, right. But once you, you know, introduce this condition, and presumably, well, you know, for Goofy theory, this is maybe a much more achievable goal, but what's your take on that?
So,
just the fact that, that in the case of matrix model, which is extremely important, is not just that you look at randomizable and non-randomizable, but there's a notion of finding graph as this extension to planar and non-planar.
Yes, yes.
So, and that's a used, you know, that's an amazing tool for.
Yes, of course, to understand also the Feynman graphs, properties, and things like this. Yes, of course, this is the goal by itself, I understand that.
So what's your take on this notion of planarity?
The planarity...
Or, analogy, you know, whatever, something that extends...
The planarity would be just, as it's just that notion of types on graph that has been defined, okay? The planarity will be extended to a new sense, and it will be just kind of manifold-like, if you want, the graphs, and planarity will be extended in that sense, because we expect that planarity, which are the planar graph, which are the dominant ones, okay, in matrix model, should be now extended into types one graph kind of features. I cannot be more precise. It's just a kind of spherical object, okay, which should be. Has to be replaced with notion in any dimension. How can I say more?
More questions?
Okay.
Well, thanks.